Please help me welcome Luis G. from Guatemala City, Guatemala.
Wow. Good morning, AA. My name is Luis, and I'm an alcoholic from Guatemala. My sobriety date is November 15, 1991. And I belong to the Grupo Serenidad of Guatemala City. It's open every day from 6:30 to 8, an hour and a half. If you're in Guatemala, look up for Grupo Serenidad. And I'm going to share with you a little story in 19 minutes that of a useless, helpless, miserable human being. I was born in Nicaragua, actually. My dad is Nicaraguan and my mom is Guatemalan. I used to go to a Catholic school in Nicaragua. And I remember when I was 7 years, I felt alone. I felt strange. I felt that I was not loved. I was thinking that and remember that going on the bus, many kids did some bullying. And I said, with this size, no more bullying. My family, I don't come from a drinking family, so I was always, I remember, I was afraid of everything and everybody, just like afraid, I didn't know why. So I was like, because I was very afraid, I did behave very well. I didn't drink till I was 18 years old. But I remember the first drink that I took. It was amazing. And that first drink, I've been hearing stories about how people drink socially and this. No way. First drink, blackout. So I start drinking and drinking nonstop for 4 years and a half. My life has become unmanageable. It was crazy. I was harming the people that I love. I was harming all the people around me. I had about a dozen DUIs or something like that. I don't remember. Because I used to drink and drive. So I kept on drinking. And my family, they sent me to a psychiatrist. And he said, Luis, you know what your problem is? You're drinking too much. And I said, me? And so he said, you're going to drink only one beer a day. And you're going to take these pills, one in each meal. And it worked for a week. And then something very bad happened in my life. I shouldn't be standing here. I was drinking and driving at about 120 miles per hour. And I hit a police car. Out of a million cars in Guatemala, I picked you know, nothing happened to me physically, but the accident has had fatal consequences. I shouldn't be standing here, but I'm here. So, you know, my family, they said, this is it. So they sent me up to an addiction treatment program in Miami. By not willing, because I didn't want to be an alcoholic, they sent me by force. I remember that I was with my father and mother flying in the plane. And I guess they told my dad, give him alcohol. So he stayed quiet in the plane. So I was drinking in the plane like crazy. And as an alcoholic, I said, I'm going to do something that they will send me back in immigration. And I did. And the immigration officer at Miami Airport asked me, what is the purpose of your trip? And I said, you know, I'm a very drunk. And I'm terrible. And then he said, immigration officer said, you need it. Welcome to the USA. And then I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I had lots of problems because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I said, no, I'm too young. I'm too young. I was 23 years old, and I said, no way. But one miracle thing happened. That's why I love institutional work, that into the hospital, an AA group came, an AA meeting, and we went to that AA meeting, and for my first time in my life, I didn't felt alone. I felt that I belong. I felt that like I found something. And I felt like I know now the love of AA. Then they suggested to get a sponsor. But I needed a very tough sponsor. So I got a sponsor. He's sitting there, Miguel from Miami. And I remember the first week I was talking to Miguel. You know, I yelled at him, and I got in a very big fight with him. Very bad. But the next day, you know, I need help. So I called him and I said, Miguel, I'm sorry. Then it was a time to go back to Guatemala. And I went back to Guatemala afraid. Panic. I said, I'm going to drink in Guatemala. Then in Guatemala, I came into a very small group. I wanted to challenge AA. And I called GSO office and said, could you send me the list of AA groups in Guatemala? And they didn't have internet or something, and they said the whole list. You know, I thought maybe two or three groups in Guatemala. And they sent me, okay, we'll get copies and we'll send that tomorrow to your house. They sent me over 100 pages for 1,000 groups. And then I wanted to challenge AA again. I went into an AA meeting and they have a raffle, and they were giving away the big book. And I said, you know, for my first time, I said, is there a higher power? If I get the big book, because I never got anything, I will surrender. And out of 300 people, I got it. Then I came into AA, and I was complaining about the toilet and about the ashtrays, and a very nice lady said, Luis, you are very right. From now on, you should be in charge of cleaning the toilet. And I was born in a very spoiled family. I have never cleaned a toilet or my bed or something. But I need it. So I did it, I learned. So I cleaned toilets. Then they said, you're going to clean. Before we used to have ceramic cups for coffee. So it was like 100 cups in ceramic that I have to clean. And also, we have to clean ashtrays. I never smoke, well, cigarettes, but so then talking about the steps, first step, you know, I said to my higher power, help me out. I was not drinking, but I need to stop suffering in AA. And I talked to a guy in Guatemala about the fourth step that I was very afraid. And he said, Luis, don't do the first step because you are going to drink. And I said, yes, don't do the first step. Then I called my sponsor to Miami. And he said, paper and pencil now. So I went into the fourth step, fifth step, seeing how Luis was a helpless, useless alcoholic. And then I talked to my sponsor again, and he suggested to read Bill's story and the Doctor Opinion and the fifth chapter. And he said, Luis, but you have to read the black part of the book. And you see how I've been in university, and but intelligence doesn't work here. Because then I, like for 2 hours, I said, what is the big black part in the big book? Now I know. So then I discovered so many defects of character, like fear. That is like my favorite one, fear. Then it becomes to do amends. Talking about the police accident, I have to keep doing amends. In the process, you know, I told my sponsor, you know, I'm so grateful about AA. I don't know how to pay AA. And he said, seven tradition and service. Then the group elected me GSR. I said, what? What is GSR? GSR. I think they wanted to get rid of me. Then, you know, I finished GSR and I went to the district committee as a secretary, treasurer, and director. Then, you know, I kept telling my sponsor, now what I do in service, that's it? No, he said, no, you need to do more amends. So then I went as a delegate to the conference in Guatemala. And the service that I'm doing, first of all, it has kept me away from drinking. It has kept me away to get bored in AA. We needed to do more service, and there were some elections to trustee, and I said, will you willing? Okay, I don't know. Okay, let's go. And it's been a wonderful journey, being in service. I know in a year and a half, I'll finish my structure service. And the same lady, many years ago, she said, Luis, you know I love you, and we're expecting you again to clean the toilet. Talking about amends. Then, you know, because I asked. That's what I have learned in AA. Ask your sponsor, ask an old-timer. And I said, Miguel, should I stop doing amends? No. And right now, you know, I have an excellent relation with my parents, my brothers and sisters, and because that's the 12th step to carry this message in all of our affairs, and that's what I think. In these 18 years, life has been very good and has been very bad situations. But AA always has been there for me. Always. I don't need to pick up a drink. And I don't know when, but when I asked my higher power, God, and I said, help me out. I want to be with you. And the desire to stop drinking went out completely. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I never imagined that I would be here. I should be in other place, you know. I think. Well, an alcoholic thinking, but I believe. I believe that we should be, every one of us, ambassadors of the AA message of love. You know, not for us. We're here, we're sober. But for the suffering alcoholic that is still out there, that doesn't know that AA exists, and for the child that is going to born today, bound to be an alcoholic. God bless you.
Thank you, Louis. And our second speaker is Amy T. from Jenks, Oklahoma.
Hi, I'm Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since February 25th of 1992, and like Louise, I also have 18 years of sobriety. And I got sober when I was 18, so, yeah, that's... So what a journey my life has been. You know, I never imagined that I would ever be doing anything like this, and what an incredible weekend this has been. You know, whenever I come to gatherings like this, it just makes me realize how naive I am to a lot of things, and you know, listening to Louise has been so exciting. I've just been kind of like a little girl around him, just so excited, and you know, listening to his experiences in Guatemala. It's incredible. And, you know, I was sitting in the back talking to Bill Clark, and he was, you know, I couldn't understand anything he was saying because he was way smarter than me. But you know, I've had one amazing experience this weekend after another, and I'm just honored to be asked to participate in the closing ceremonies of AA's 75th anniversary. So thank you. You know, like I said, I mean, I've come a long way. I mean, I've practically grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, whenever I got here, I never had to pay for anything myself. I never had to do anything on my own. I never really made a decision for myself until I got sober. And I mean, like, not an adult type decision, but I had my first drink when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and like a lot of people say, you know, I mean, it just changed everything. It changed me, and I wanted to feel like that always, and, you know, those are the kind of feelings that I've been able to find in Alcoholics Anonymous, just, you know, among the fellowship, through working the steps, but at that moment, you know, that is what I needed to mask the pain that I pretty much just created for myself. But I loved it. I loved alcohol. You know, I loved it up until the moment I got sober because it was still working for me. What wasn't working for me was my life. And because right after I took that first drink, everything about me changed. You know, I no longer wanted to be close to my family. You know, I was a classic antisocial personality. You know, I immediately just stopped having regard for anyone in my life. You know, I pushed my parents away. I became violent. It was kind of funny. I was telling Louise before the meeting that I had left my purse up here with Miguel. And you know, I was like, oh, I'm not worried about it. I was like, I used to be a purse snatcher. And I did, you know. I mean, I was one of those people that, you know, I just became resourceful in any way that could benefit me as far as my alcoholism goes, because, you know, my obsession from early on in my drinking, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't drink for very long. I drank for about 5 years, I became resourceful in how to get my alcohol, and a lot of that came through stealing. You know, I had a lot of fun with it for a while, but, you know, you lose friends. Nobody wants to be around you, and I just became a loner. I got arrested for stealing when I was about 17, and my parents decided to send me to treatment because I had been arrested on numerous occasions, all for assault and battery. And they sent me to a treatment center. And, you know, I can tell you that that was the first time in my life that I ever really felt like I fit in anywhere. Was in the treatment center, and it's because I just related to people. I related to the way they drank, and I related to their lifestyles, and I related to just everything. And I loved it. I had a blast while I was there. You know, I had absolutely no, I did not have the capacity to look at myself at all at that moment in time. But you know, the greatest thing that my parents paid for that, you know, 28 days or 30 days was the fact that I knew where to go whenever it was time for me to get sober. And, you know, I left there with the information that I was an alcoholic. I believed that. And I just proceeded to go live my life. And I knew at that moment that all I needed to do was to not drink. And, you know, I had no idea about the mental obsession. I had no idea that I had the mind of a chronic alcoholic and that I was destined to drink again. And so I did. I think I stayed sober for about 3 months, and I drank, and I lasted out there about 16 more months. My life became a literal hell. I was living on the streets pretty much by myself. You know, I'd stay in my car. I would, what they now call couch surf from place to place, and I would just stay with whoever would let me. You know, it didn't matter who it was, but I really didn't have any friends. I used everyone. No one wanted to be around me, and, you know, I was stinky too. But, I got involved with a young man, or I guess he was older than me at the time. I was 18 and he was 21, and we got involved in some armed robberies, or we performed them, and I ended up going to jail when I was 18 years old. And we hurt some people pretty badly, and like Louise, you know, I'm really grateful that I'm, you know, on this side of the fence today. But I ended up having to do some prison time when I was 18. I turned 19 2 days before I got sentenced, and I was 21 when I got out. So, you know, whenever I got to prison, I knew where to go because I had been to that treatment center, and I'd been to a couple meetings, you know, they had AA there, and there were people that showed up, and they drove for like 45 minutes or an hour to come share their message of hope. And, you know, just to kind of give you an idea of where I was coming from, whenever I went to jail, I was in there for 85 days, and whenever I left, the guy that we had harmed was still in intensive care. And so, you know, I felt really like a bad person about that. And, you know, I had a hard time believing that God would ever want anything to do with me. You know, that coupled with everything else that I had done to people. And, you know, I sat in the meetings and I listened to what you guys had to say. And, you know, day by day, I just got a little bit more hope. And, you know, I started believing that maybe this program could work for me. And maybe, you know, I could stay sober. And, you know, I'm so grateful today for those people. You know, I get to do that today. You know, I get to carry messages into the prison, or the message into the prisons. And, you know, it's really a cool deal to go back where I was and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and let, you know, the women know that, I mean, they can stay sober too. And it took a long time for me to really have any confidence. You know, I think I learned very early on that I had to start taking responsibility for myself, because I don't know. I mean, I was like a person that was out there like victimizing everyone that walked in my path, but I was the victim. You know, I was the one that was like, you know, couldn't believe anybody was gonna, you know, or anyway, I was the one that was that felt like the victim. And you know, you guys taught me that I was the one out there doing that. And whenever I got out, I started going to a lot of meetings. You know, I got a sponsor, and you know, that woman saved my life. And you know, I don't even know where she is today, but she really did save my life. And she went to a lot of meetings with me. She took me through the steps, and you know, I'm forever grateful for, you know, the angels that God has put in my life. And you know, it's kind of funny, because whenever I asked that woman to sponsor me, she kind of was like, you know, I told her, I was like, well, I'm in treatment and I need to get a sponsor. And she said, well, you know, she said, I'll give you my number, but no one from treatment's ever called me before. And, you know, for someone like me, that was exactly what I needed to hear, because, you know, I needed that challenge. And what happened was I called her every day. And so I don't know. I mean, I remember looking at the steps for the first time and thinking that they were really stupid, you know, and thinking how can those things, you know, they just seem so simple. And not that I'm, you know, a really complex person, because I'm not, but, you know, I really didn't believe that, you know, that they would work for me. And but I mean, obviously, something has changed, I don't know. I mean, I got involved with the Young People's Conference in my area. It used to be called Austripaw, and now it's Okiepaw. You know, I started going to Ikiepaw, and you know, been to that several years. And you know, I just started getting really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and becoming a part of the whole. You know, not, you know, just not. You know, I learned how to Francisco talked last night about needing love. And, you know, I think that that's what we all need in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, we need to love each other. And that's, you know, I've learned how to do that through the fellowship. You know, I've learned how to, you know, just connect with people. And, you know, it's just been an amazing journey. I was able to finish college in sobriety. I got 2 degrees, and, you know, I've been able to have the most amazing jobs ever. You know, and I mean, those are things I never thought someone like myself could ever do. You know, I had that limitation, I had that felony, you know, and today it's like one of my biggest pet peeves to hear people say that. And you know, I was guilty of it for years. You know, well, I can't do that because I have a felony. You know, I can't do that. And you know, today my God is bigger than that. You know, my God is bigger than any record. Because, you know, my understanding is, you know, when I suit up and show up, that, you know, God is going to open the door that I need to walk through. So it doesn't matter, you know, what, I mean, I really have to change my thinking around that. You know, I have to change my thinking, because if I limit myself in my thinking, then, you know, it really is. And so, like, just for example, whenever I've gone on job interviews, I've, you know, a lot of times just, you know, I just pray about it and ask God to put me where He wants me to be, you know, and that's what I do with my life. You know, I just ask God to put me where He wants me to be, and that way there's no questions, you know, there's no questions about it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this journey is incredible. And I don't know. I've made friends with some law enforcement people in my area, and I know some you know, and the, what is it, the deputy chief of police in Tulsa has been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, an open AA meeting, and you know, it was really cool because he came and he got it. You know, he got what we do here, and he called it other directedness. And he said, you know, a lot of organizations could benefit from the other directedness. And so he saw, you know, just from coming to that meeting, that you know, what we do, and we embrace the newcomer, and you know, and how amazing that is. I don't know. I just, when I was new, nobody ever said, no, you can't come in my house. You just got out of prison. You know, I don't want to be around you. What did you do? No one asked me questions like that. You know, they just said, come with me. You know, we're going to this meeting, or we're going here to eat, or, you know, I felt really welcome. And, you know, I hope that I can always do that, you know, for the person that comes up to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I don't know. I really don't have that much else to say. This seems like the longest 20 minutes of my life, but I'm so grateful to be here. And, you know, like I said, I love AA and I love you. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. And finally, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our third speaker this morning, Steve L. from Brentwood, Tennessee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. I'm honored and privileged and humbled beyond words to share this morning with Luis and Amy and all of you, to share this weekend celebrating Alcoholics Anonymous' 75th anniversary. To have looked around over the last few days, I am struck at the diversity of our fellowship. All present here. I've seen it in the streets as we've walked along. I've seen and heard it in the folks that have shared in the different panels and workshops and your speakers up here Friday, Saturday, and this morning. And what strikes me in that is that we're bound together by a common problem. But that common problem would not keep us together if not coupled with a solution upon which we can absolutely agree. I know that in our book it says that the classification of alcoholics is in many ways outside the scope of our book. And then, not unlike many of us, it goes on and classifies a few. It talks about the psychopath. I've spotted three of you here this week. I will not point you out, but you know who you are. It talks about the manic depressive, who's perhaps the most positive. It talks about the guy who perhaps, not having had a drink for a long period, thinks he can drink again successfully. And it talks about the type that is like other men in every respect except the effect that alcohol has upon him. But then it clarifies that common problem. It says that all these and many others have one symptom in common that sets them apart as a distinct entity, and that is the phenomenon of craving, the allergy to alcohol. And I think that is the common flag which I stand under with everyone who says he or she is an alcoholic, as Alcoholics Anonymous describes one. And that was news to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing of the allergy. I did not know. You know, it says in the doctor's opinion that they were interested in his theory about the allergy, for it explains that for which there is no other explanation. And I was interested in that theory when I got here. Because why couldn't I just have a couple? Why did I, on those times when I did not intend to? You know, how did I accidentally get drunk so often? Many times it was planned and on purpose, but sometimes it was by accident. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1989. And I'm a member of the backroom group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets every Saturday and Sunday morning in Nashville, Tennessee, and they're gathering right now. They've noticed my absence, and they are excited by that. Let me tell you, it's a great group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is not a great group simply because we have great meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it, I believe, is because of the activity that takes place between meetings by our group members, and our outreach to correctional facilities and treatment centers, and our social activities and fellowshipping within the group, and our 12-stepping one with another. So I'm a very proud member and grateful member of the backroom group. I told you my sobriety date is June 30th, 1989. On July the 1st of 1989, my friend Ricky came by to drive me off to a treatment facility. And it wasn't because I had had some epiphany that my life needed some moral uplift, or that I wanted or needed to stop drinking. It was simply to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, where I had a year before been convicted of my 6th DUI, and as part of the plea bargain of that agreement, I had been given some weekends in jail, and they had cut some of that time down if I would attend residential drug and alcohol treatment. I did not know what that was, but it sounded painful. And now, when Ricky drove me over there that morning, now he picked me up. I had been out the day before, spent it with my wife Connie and my daughter Abby, who was 5 years old at the time. Connie gave me the kind of support that I know a lot of my brethren in AA don't get. As Ricky and I were leaving, she said, "No matter what, honey, don't stop drinking." And Connie's sobriety date is 10 days after mine. And I have to share with you that while people say time doesn't matter, that is a very important 10 days to me. As you might appreciate, any time there's a little disagreement or argument at our house, I just say, "Wait 10 days, baby, it'll all come clear to you." And I wouldn't tell you that if I wasn't going to tell you this. She's a wonderful member of AA. And we've got a wonderful marriage and a wonderful home today as a result of what you have done for us. And Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well in our home. And people we sponsor are regularly in and out of it. Ricky dropped me off at that treatment facility. As we were riding, he said, "Steve, what do you think this deal's going to be like?" And I said, "I don't have any idea, Ricky." I said, but I'll tell you one thing. I said, I'm not going to get in some little circle and go, I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic, and whine about the most intimate details of my life. And about 10 days later, I was just telling people way more than they wanted to know about me. And you know, that it was a wonderful freedom. I don't confuse what happened as a fourth step and a fifth step, but it was an unburdening. It was letting a little air out of the balloon. It was finally just saying a lot of things that I had that never been able to say. The second day that I was at that facility, two men from Alcoholics Anonymous came in. And they explained to us the difference between Alcoholics Anonymous and the facility that we were in. And they said, we're getting ready to have an AA meeting. See, there is a difference, and they both have great value, but it was important for me and continues to be for me to understand the difference. And what they did was they spent that evening doing what I believe Alcoholics Anonymous suggests a guy like me do. They showed up as ex-problem drinkers in whom the problem had been solved, properly armed with the facts about themselves. And you know, I have to remember that because I am perhaps my most dangerous and least effective when I am properly armed with the facts about you. And that's even if I'm right about the facts. Because what they allowed me to do that evening was listen. They said, sit back, relax. You don't have to do a thing. They offered me a message of hope and recovery that they said had worked for them. They weren't trying to sell me. They weren't trying to convert me. They weren't on a membership drive for Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those men has passed away. The other man, George, I call every June the 30th and thank him for the role that he played in my recovery. And it challenges me to make sure, am I that guy for the next man or woman that comes along? Am I willing to be there and share the story with someone else? After a little time in that facility, I got out, and that 28 days sober, I went down to 202 the Friendship House in Nashville, Tennessee. And I wandered upstairs, and I walked into a room of about 11 or 12 people that changed my life. And they were having a big book study. I didn't know there was such a thing. I would much have preferred to be in an open discussion meeting. I love an open discussion meeting because I can't wait to hear what I have to say in one. And therein lies my problem. And downstairs at the half measures table, the people up in that room were referred to as big book thumpers, and it wasn't a term of endearment. But let me share with you that they did not thump me with that book, but what they did do was introduce me to the message contained in it. What they did do was help me find myself so I could decide whether I identified with the problem and whether I was interested in the solution. I found my first sponsor, Frank, in that meeting. And he meant a lot to me. He shared with me. He was not a tactful man. But despite what some others may have seen, he was a kind and loving man to me. But more importantly, he was interested, and he told me, he said, Steve, why don't you sit in here for a while? Why don't you take a look at what's in this book where the integrity of the message is protected so that you'll know when you go out and hear about the message of recovery, you'll know whether it's the message that's in this book. and the message that you share will come from this book and your experience based on what you found here. And that is what I've endeavored to do. At a year sober, I moved to Richmond, Virginia. And I was embraced by many folks over there and a new sponsor named Joe. I was once getting ready to speak before the largest group I'd ever talked before at the time, 200 people. I said, "Joe, I'm a little nervous before a crowd this large." He said, "Steve, don't worry." He said, "By the time you're done, it'll be down to the size you're used to." That could happen here today, but in the short time I have left, I want to tell you a point of view that Joe shared with me that's been helpful. As we looked at how it works, and as was read earlier, and he said some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. And he said, "Steve, don't be imprisoned by your old ideas. Don't be limited by your old ideas." Because I said, "Joe, to me that sounds like I never had a good idea before I got to AA. And I've got some damn good ideas." And he said, "Steve, I'm certain that you do." He said, "I have not heard any of them yet, but I'm certain that you do." But what he shared with me is that you weren't asking me to discard my ideas. You weren't telling me that they did not have value. He said, "Steve, you just can't tell the good ideas from the bad ideas." He said, "So be willing to set them all down. Submit yourself to this process. And what the truth will find its way back to you. You may find a better idea that will serve you better and allow you to serve others better." The next thing, you know, I stopped drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you encouraged me to get down to causes and conditions. Because the way I felt, the things that I did drinking, I went down the wrong way to the interstate, had a head-on collision, totaled 4 cars, sent people to the hospital. My last DUI was hitting a Brentwood police officer in a car going the wrong way down the street. A lot of drunk stuff happens, but I was drunk when that happened. But what I could not understand was why I felt the way I felt sober. With a wife that loved me, with a daughter, with a job, with a house, with a car, what was missing? Why do I secretly have these feelings that I can't explain or articulate? I didn't connect them to my drinking at all. And I showed up here and you said, "Give yourself over to these steps. Take these actions," which, as Amy says, seem unconnected to the problem that I have. "And you will have a spiritual experience," which is explained to me in Appendix 2 as a profound alteration in my reaction to life. I experience this life differently today than the one I had before. I don't know what my recovery looks like to other people. I don't have a dramatic drunkalogue or a dramatic story of recovery. I'm the poster boy for middle-class alcoholism. But what I can tell you is that a middle-class alcoholic can walk around lost, empty, afraid, with no idea where those feelings are coming from. And afraid to voice them because other people are saying, "You know, what's your problem?" People weren't telling me to stop drinking. They were telling me to grow up, to be responsible, to be a man, to be a husband, to be a father. You have taught me how to do all those things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to end by doing one other thing that I believe our book suggests I do. And it says in our personal stories, each of us in his own language and from his own point of view, talks about how he established a relationship with a higher power. There's a wonderful man and another mentor of mine in Nashville, Tennessee, named Mo H. And Mo contracted cancer back in October of 03. He passed away, or December. In October, we had breakfast one morning. We knew it was probably the last time we were going to be together, he and another friend of mine, Jerry. And as Jerry went to get the car, I asked Mo a question. Mo had always recited the verse to a poem as he ended his talks. And the first time I heard it over 13 years ago, I knew that it described my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous as succinctly as anything that I had ever heard. And I asked Mo that morning if he would allow me to close my talks by also sharing that poem. Because in the truest sense of AA, it would help me pass on what he had given to me. And it would help me remember him. And he said, Steve, he was a little embarrassed, you know, but he was pleased, I could tell as well. And he said, Steve, if you think it'll help another drunk. Because that's all that Mo cared about. He loved alcoholics more than anyone I'd ever known. And I can tell you that sometimes a guy like me can sober up in AA and about a half hour later not like alcoholics. All of a sudden, I can't understand why they won't act better. And when that perennial slipper would come back to the meeting and when I might act busy or duck my head or grab a cup of coffee so he doesn't come over to me, I would look up and Mo would be running to him, arms open, giving him a hug, saying, we love you. We're glad you're back. So through his example, I know I want to be a better man and I want to be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The simple poem was, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, that is what you've allowed me to do. By you sharing your lives with me, by allowing me to share my life with you, you've introduced me to a power that guides my life. You've given me a purpose, and it is the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some days I've got a better idea, but when I don't, all I need to do is stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you so much for having me here today.